He said a healthy relationship goes like this: have to, need to, want to, love to. My teacher always says to me, when you see through the illusion, you got to come back to it with a different motivation. Big book, steps, sponsor, meetings, don't keep me sober. My alcoholic mind says, then I don't need to go to meetings, have a sponsor, read the book, or work the steps. No, you come to them from a different motivation. I do these things to seek a deeper relationship with the thing that keeps me sober. I come to it from maybe the second time through the work, it's because you need to. You'll never have the desperation you had the first time. You're not going to get yourself back into it. You're not going to be able to work it up into an emotional state, because all it'll be is memory and emotion. And we already know the memory of a week ago ain't going to keep us sober. Think it through. I got the kind of mind, I don't know about you, if I was to think my next drunk through, I'd just say, fuck it. Take a drink. Thinking it through depresses me like positive affirmations make me feel. I've read positive affirmations and felt like a piece of you're the perfect child of the universe. No, I'm not. I've always thought they should have a I'm going to write it before I'm 25 years sober. I'm going to write a daily affirmation book for alcoholics that you would feel better after reading. You're a piece of shit, you'll never amount to nothing. Because you know you're a little better than that, but you're not a perfect child of the universe who's loved by everybody, right? Yeah. Today's going to be worthless, you're not going to accomplish anything, and everything after that's going to be uphill, right? I think I'm going to write that, right? Joe Hawk's positive affirmations for real alcoholics. Right? You don't need to do the work today. Forget 10, 11, and 12. Everything's going to be hunky-dory. And you might find out, because you're in the grace of God, that that's true too. Don't beat yourself up for not being rigid. Be free. Do what you want. You should. 10, 11, and 12 are a requirement based on some kind of fear. It's going to be horrible. Oh, I'm going to drink. Mark told me if I don't do 10, 11, and 12, I'm going to drink again. No, you're past that. You've recovered. You're in a state of neutrality. Do it out. So then I got, oh, then I'm just not going to do it. No, come to it from a different motivation. What about going through the work based on your love for God before you're all fucked up and have to do the work again? What about doing the work from love? Have to, need to, want to, love to. Maybe this time you're going to do it just because you want to. You want to see what's on the other side of the work this time, right? I can't open this right now, but you get to the doctor's opinion. You open your heart up with a prayer for an open mind and a new experience. Different statements are going to pop up each time through the work. Find the ones that speak to you. Maybe there'll be some new ones. Maybe you'll find that a statement, let's say for an example, if you don't find ease and comfort, the same ease and comfort you used to get from drinking, there's very little hope for your recovery. What if this time the consideration was, I have found more ease and comfort in my life than drinking or drugs ever gave me, but now ease and comfort have become a noose around my neck that I'd like to get past because I'm worshiping ease and comfort, and I have fallen victim to the belief that if it feels good, it's good, and if it feels bad, it's bad. Maybe that question comes out of the doctor's opinion. Let the doctor's opinion speak to your heart. Let the big book meet you. It's one of these books, and we've all read other books. There's very few, though. It's one of these books that meets you where you are, whether it's the first time and you're lucky enough not to know much about AA. Don't you love to work with those people that haven't been fucked up by the fellowship yet? Just like wet, ready. They don't know. You been to AA? No. Oh, thank God. Right? Right? They're much easier to work with than some idiot with 20 years that has all these ideas about what he thinks he knows. Mark said to me, not too many, just a few months ago, when I asked him to take me through the work, he said, I'm at a loss at to what to do with you. I thought, because I'm a challenge. He said, no, you know too much. You know too much. You better pray. Damn, he kept me in that fucking prayer until I was just like, you know how I knew I was ready to take the third step with him the other day? I said to my roommate, in Terrell, Texas, I said to my roommate, I'm really looking forward to starting my inventory. Never said that before in 20 years, right? That's when you know you're ready for inventory. Oh, I've taken the third step, but my inventory is going to be terrible. It's going to be horrible. I'm going to be all messed up in inventory again. You don't have to. You don't have to. You'll never do the work for the first time again. Even those of you in the room that don't think the amends that are left in your gut at 3 o'clock in the morning have anything to do with booze, but you've run out of power in step 9 and you can't make any more and you just need kind of an oomph. Right? You got to go back through. It took me starting the work twice to get through it once. Right? Maybe some of you have had to start it 4 times to get through it once. Maybe some of you have thought you've done it 3 times, but you haven't done it once. Right? Doctor's opinion, you turn statements into questions that meet your heart. Bill's story, you go back to your drunk log in the first 9 pages, and the next 9 pages, use it as a barometer. This is a great thing for the person that's taking you through. Mark anything in 9 to 16 you're resistant to do that he did. Because all you're going to get in 9 to 16 is what's going to come in the rest of the work. It's a great barometer for the sponsee and the sponsor. And you know when they marked everything in 9 to 16? There's still one that bothers me every time it's time for me to do the work. To admit again that in and of myself I am nothing and that without God I'm lost. And I'm not saying 9 to 16, for some of you there'll be a lot of stuff that you're absolutely unwilling to do. I'm saying the stuff you feel a little resistant to. That pulls on you. Mark it. You know why it's a great barometer? When you're done with step 1, go back and see if there's any resistance left in 9 to 16. 17 to 23, all you got to do is be convinced of one thing to go on past page 23. Does your experience abundantly confirm that once you put alcohol in your system, something happens where you lose control over the amount once you start? Then do it all with drugs if you had both involved. I don't want to spend a bunch of time on the debate. You're either alcoholic or you're not. You're either a real addict or you're not. But the page that helped me, because I've had the physical craving for drugs. You can't do the kind of drugs. But here's the thing, though. My mother would get a physical craving for crack cocaine. She's not a real addict. Anybody shooting cocaine is going to get a physical craving. My first time through the work, I saw I had the physical craving for alcohol. I had the physical craving for drugs. So far, I think Don and I are going to find that I'm an alcoholic and an addict. I've had the mental obsession for drugs. When you have a habit, a physical habit for heroin, you know about the mental obsession. When you shoot cocaine, you know about the mental obsession. I'm all the way to page 43, and I'm thinking I'm going to find out I'm an alcoholic addict. That's okay. That'll be my truth. I'll do the work. He went back to one page that separates the men from the boys. The girls from the real women. The moderate, the hard, and the real alcoholic. I didn't have any debate whether I was a moderate drinker or a moderate drug user. We get to the real addict. I've had the habit badly enough to gradually impair me physically and mentally. I've had big habits. Could have killed me a few years before my time, but here's what separated me from the real addict. Given a sufficiently strong reason, can you stop? That doesn't mean the reason that brought you to AA. Everybody's here with a sufficient reason that brought him here. The question would be, would the sufficient reason that brought you to Alcoholics Anonymous by itself be enough for you to stay stopped now? Without any spiritual nothing. They even give you a test in the book to find out. Just leave it alone for a year or so, right? The drinking test I don't believe in anymore. There's one of my old ideas that's not old anymore. If an alcoholic is sober, and I believe they're in the grace of God. Now, if somebody's still drinking with a certain pattern and they want to find out whether they're alcoholic or not, have them stop abruptly and try some controlled drinking. But if somebody's in the grace of God because they're sitting here sober, how do you know if they took the test and they passed that they weren't safe and protected by God and they passed the test? And you killed them because you gave them a test to somebody who's in the grace of God. Because I know people who've drank in the grace of God and there was no craving. I don't believe in Marty Mann's test for somebody who's sober and in the grace of God. I believe in Marty Mann's test the way she wrote it. And she didn't say two drinks a day for 30 days. I read Marty Mann's primer on alcoholism, first edition. She said two drinks a day, same time, same amount, every day for 6 months while drinking to see if you can stop the pattern of the craving. Try to drink and stop abruptly. I don't believe in the test for people that are sober. There's better ways to find out. Leave the program, don't do any spiritual work, and see what happens to your spiritual condition. Right? 23 to 43? That's when it'll start to strike your heart. Because it's where we all are. I hope that for everybody in this room, to look at the craving is either a not too far memory or a distant memory. And all you're going to get from it is memory, and if somebody can scare you enough into thinking that craving would still be true. Probably would. But where it always gets me is 23 to 43. So, am I a hard drinker? I had a habit for alcohol. It physically and mentally impaired me. But given a sufficient strong reason, I couldn't quit drinking. I couldn't even quit drinking on the sufficient reason that brought me here because I didn't quit drinking. I woke up one day, August 17th, 1982, scared to death because for the first time in 18 years, I couldn't drink. I like Bill's description from my experience. I was separated from alcohol on August 17th, 1982. Every time I ever quit, I couldn't stay quit. So one has to do with the start, and one has to do with the stop. But do you believe now maybe you've acquired enough information or enough power or enough grace to drink like a normal person? Who in this room would ever want to drink like a normal person? Some people in this room had times when there was control, but did you enjoy it? And when you enjoyed it, were you controlling it? I never had both at the same time. Control and enjoy, right? Then you start to look at 44, 45, and 52. See, I don't suffer from a twofold disease. I do not suffer from a twofold disease, and the physical craving is not separate from the mental obsession. I've been to some groups, they'll tell you that the powerless part of the first step is the physical craving, and the unmanageability part of the first step is the mental obsession. Then where is everybody in the room that the mental obsession has been removed from? Where's your unmanageability? I'm sorry. My book happens to say on page 64 that I'm not only bodily and mentally ill, I'm spiritually sick. And when the spiritual malady is overcome, I'm going to straighten out mentally and physically. I have a threefold disease. You got to have two parts to be powerless. It's not having the physical craving or the mental obsession. And there's one of those traps we're going to look at when we come back after the break on page 44. If when you honestly want to, you can't quit entirely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount and somebody you're working with that's not quite clear yet up to after all those pages, they'll always say, see, it says or. You don't have to have both. You only got to have one or the other. But I'm going to tell you this. If you get the mental obsession on a regular basis, but you don't get a physical craving, then the next time you get a mental obsession, just drink the way you want to drink. And if you get the physical craving every time you drink, but there's no mental obsession, then just make up your mind, go on with your life, and have a happy time because you can keep yourself stopped. You got to have both to be powerless. And my life happens to be unmanageable because of something much deeper than circumstance, emotion, how things are going, how I feel, how you feel about me, whether you love me or not. That's called a spiritual malady beyond emotion or circumstance. Some of you drink when she stays. Some of you drink when she leaves. Some of you don't know which one's the celebration and which one's the depression. And sometimes they're interchangeable. I'm depressed when she's there. I'm depressed when she leaves. I want her to come back. Then I'm depressed. I want her to leave again. I'm still depressed. It's because I'm fucking depressed. I take me with me wherever I go, right? You drink because the team won. Yankees won, you drink. Yankees lose, you drink. You know the days I like to drink? When I just need to feel something because everything is just kind of, right? How many in the room on depressive medication, sober? That's a reservation about a human power being able to relieve your alcoholism. Unless you have a valid chemical imbalance. Do the work. Finish nine. See if it was untreated alcoholism or something that really needs to be treated. I'm not a doctor. I'm not going to tell you how to get off it. I'm going to tell you, though, 80% of those on medication have a lurking notion about their first step, and they're looking for something human to relieve what they suffer from. And I've seen a lot of you do 1 through 9 and find out the symptoms were just untreated alcoholism because they're so similar. There's a difference between alcoholism and drug addiction. If there isn't, then how come there's alcoholics in this room that could take or leave drugs? And how come there's drug addicts in this room that could take or leave alcohol? It's only different in one respect, the physical craving. The mental obsession, an alcoholic and an addict can talk about all day long. The spiritual malady, an alcoholic and an addict can talk about all day long. But I need to talk to a guy that knows what it's like to wake up in the morning craving alcohol. Not needing to go get a hit of crack. Why? Because I made up my mind and I walked away from cocaine. Some people are both. Use the pages with both. Find out what you are. Let's come back at 10:30. Just a couple things, and then Mark's going to move on with the mechanics of 4 through 9. Then we can get to experience. If in any way I offended anybody when I used the word retard, I will tell you this. I shared it that way because I was offended also, and that's the way it was being referred to. The idea that there should be any debate about that is as crazy as should there be any debate about what's going on with priests nowadays. That controversy. The idea that it's even something to debate. I remember seeing a paper that said, Supreme Court makes controversial decision about execution. And I thought, my God, how insane things have gotten, you know? A lot of people will say sometimes when you meet somebody, they've heard you share in a meeting, and you talk about, let's say they come up to you and say, what does it mean to go through the work? You say, we're going to start on the title page, and we're going to go through the first 164 pages, and we're going to do what it says and follow the directions and answer the questions. But then the first thing you give them is a prayer that's not necessarily in the book. I would like to say that there's many places in the book that refer to getting past their old ideas, laying aside prejudice, many places in there. That's why I encourage people to do the set-aside prayer in their own words, in their own way, to whatever they believe in, as long as they understand the idea that maybe they're there because they would like, maybe it's the first question, would you like to have an open mind and a new experience? Because what's the thing that they say in the religious, in the spiritual experience in the appendix? There's one thing that'll keep you in everlasting ignorance, and that's contempt prior to investigation. And don't think you'll have that kind of contempt only the first time. They'll just be new, fancier, slicker, better sounding contempt. Better sounding reservations. I would like to paint a picture. I like pictures. I like to be able to see the picture in my mind. Mark and I were talking just a minute ago about a lot of people are having a lot of questions about their first step. Let me say once again, that's a reflection that you're having an experience. Those that are still stuck in what they absolutely know when they got here on Friday night are just getting some new information. Maybe the questions will be asked later. If there's doubt, it's good. Because alcoholics always know the answer to everything. But we could take not only the rest of the weekend, it would take us a week. And we would have to meet with each of you individually. And it would be a great delusion on our part to think that we can settle your first step questions. There is only one ultimate authority that can answer your first step questions, and it's not your sponsor, and it's not the person taking you through the work. It's God expressing himself in your group conscience. Mark's going to describe that group a little later. I believe everybody in that group needs to be convinced to their innermost self. And keep in mind, the big book contains the long form of the 12 traditions and the short form of the 12 traditions. The big book also contains the short form of the 12 steps and the long form of the 12 steps. Because most of you in this room know there's a lot more to step one than just admitting that you're powerless over alcohol. And one of the great things in the first step that I was just talking about and Mark was talking about, there's a difference between you getting a physical craving for booze when you drink booze than you being powerless over where alcohol takes you when you put it in your body back to what you really like. That's, I'll say that again. There's a difference between having a physical craving once you start to drink and all that. Don't get lost in the word physical craving. Someone asked me at the break, is the physical craving for crack the same feeling as the physical craving for alcohol? No. There's probably no stronger. I don't know about crack. I don't know if there's any crack addicts here, but there's many of you that look crackish. I know that. I don't want to call anyone a crack addict. But I know this. I know this. I know what the rush is like. I know what the physical craving is like after you shoot some cocaine. It's not the same after you take a few drinks. So don't get lost in how it feels. Don't get lost in the technical term physical craving or phenomena of craving. It's only simple. When you take a hit of crack, do you lose control over the amount that you're going to end up doing once you start? Does it go past what you want? You set out to do this much, can you just do that much? Same with booze. Don't get lost in the word physical craving. Don't worry what it feels like. Some of us at different progressions of our disease, it feels different. Sometimes, and some of you have been there, your system is so messed up, you take two drinks, you're flat on your face because it's all messed up. Sometimes you set out to get really drunk because you're with the right guys. You can't take that, you can't drink that much anymore. The simple question is, do you lose control over the amount you're going to drink once you start? And can you keep yourself stopped once you stop? So what I found, my truth, it can't be your truth. Some of you will find you're both, some of you will find one, you're the other. My truth was this, I am a real alcoholic. Physically, once I take a drink, I lose control over the amount. Mentally, I can't keep myself stopped once I stop. Spiritually, I relate to the spiritual malady. But there's millions of people in the world, in churches and therapy offices, that suffer from the spiritual malady, that you could talk to about the spiritual malady. They would understand everything on page 52, but it doesn't mean they're alcoholic. Which leads me to believe, just because the spiritual malady was there before I ever drank, that my admission about alcoholism has something to do with how I drank alcohol once I started and what would happen with me and alcohol when I would stop. Right? Find your truth. Mark and I can't bring you to your truth. Your sponsor can't bring you to the truth with the first step. God can show it to you, and you can fully concede to your innermost self. And fully conceding to your innermost self that you're an alcoholic, an addict, or both, Al-Anon, whatever it might be, is a little different than admitting that you're powerless. The other thing I wanted to mention, and here's the picture I'd like to draw. You see the craving. You see the obsession. You see the truth. My truth would be, if I want to get technical, I am a real alcoholic who was a hard drug user. I had the habit for drugs. It physically impaired me, mentally impaired me, just a little. It could have killed me before my time, but given a sufficiently strong reason, I was able to stop. That's my truth. Then you start to look at page 52. Not what it was like then, currently. Where are you with page 52 now? Let's call that the manifestations of the current unmanageability. And I would like you to watch that list. You should write it out. Some people need to write paragraphs about each of those areas. What is it like with relationships? My emotional nature, misery and depression, making a living that's satisfying, that you feel passionate about, being of help to other people, fear. So sometimes you got to write paragraph form and then pull out a list. Because here's what I'd like you to watch. I would like you to watch, and we'll get to it. I would like you to watch that the list of current unmanageability, which is the spiritual malady as you're currently experiencing it, will be a direct reflection of your current agnosticism. Doesn't it make sense? If you had full faith, you wouldn't be having trouble in that area. The current unmanageability will reflect your current agnosticism. Your current agnosticism will reflect where you're running your life on self-will when you look at step three. It will then put names on it, and some of it, just the way you have it written, will become your first column, which will become your fear inventory, which you'll see how you take into each relationship, which will become your amends list. I would like you to see how it grows and changes, but it's basically the list you make of the current unmanageability will be the list of agnosticism, self-will, resentment, fear, relationships, and it'll turn into your eight-step list.
When I was on the break, I was talking with a gentleman who drank last night, and he said some great stuff. I asked him to tell me a little bit about it. He said he had 3 years, and then he drank, and but we were talking, and he was talking about, you know, he seems to be a struggle with God. And I said, well, tell me about that. And he said, well, you know, when I first came in the first year or two, he said it was like I knew God and there was no face and no name. And then he said, I started reading all these spiritual books and I became a spiritual wreck. And he said, I ultimately, you know, relapsed. And thought that was interesting. You know, you second step, this idea of putting God in a box, defining, comprehending. You know, if you ask me today, do I have any concept of God, I would say absolutely not. None. Because any concept I gave you would be formulated in my mind, and God is so much more than what my mind has to say about God. I have no concept of God. My experiences have been such that I have been stripped of every concept I ever had about God, and I've had many. Came into AA, I don't know, atheist probably, agnostic. Attempted church for a little while. I didn't fit in. Still remember one time a girl saying the most significant thing in her life was there were a few times she hadn't felt close to God, and I couldn't relate to that. And then I spent some time with Native American spirituality and then some Eastern stuff, Order of St. Benedict, Catholicism, and had an experience in 96 that was so profound that it stripped me of any donkey ever again. And that's just the way that went. I don't have any concept. It's an absolute knowing. There's a story I think that really sums this thing up about God. It's like Joe and I are swimming in water, and the water is God, right? And a new guy comes by. He says, hi, how you guys doing? Oh, we said we're doing great. The water's great. And so, of course, he's got to look slick and cool. So he didn't understand what we mean by water, so he didn't say anything. But then he swims up to another new guy, and he said, we got to go find water. And the other guy says, what are you talking about? He says, well, those guys say the water's great. Where's the water? You know, and that's my experience with God, you know, closer than breathing, and I got to go find God, right? That's not been my experience anymore. Through a course of action as outlined in steps 4 through 9 and working with the disciplines of 10 and 11, is I became awake, aware, mindful, conscious of that which is closer to me than breathing, which is nameless and faceless and has no concept attached to it, if you will. I tell people to take a chill pill in the second step. You know, a drunk says to me they're struggling with God. My experience is that statement has nothing to do with God. Has a lot to do with your first step, though. If you're powerless over alcohol and your experience is such with an unmanageable life and your experience is such that to drink is to die, you're going to get pretty open-minded about God. See, faced with an alcoholic death or open-mindedness. And the book, you know, the big book is so gentle. They say, pick your own concept, right? So how can you sit in the rooms and say you're struggling with God when you get to pick your own concept? You know, AA doesn't say you have to believe in any kind of a God. You get to invent God. I mean, what greater act here? Invent me. You come up with me. I don't care. And I'll rise to meet you from that position. That's really the second step. I want to read these some of these characteristics because it ties into the third step, and then I'm going to talk about steps 4 through 9. See if any of you suffer from any of these characteristics. Number one, often become angry at or afraid of authority figures, and I will attempt to work them against each other in order to get my way. I seek approval and frequently lose my own identity in the process. Those of you that are in relationships. I'm able to make a good first impression, but unable to follow through. I have difficulty accepting personal criticism and become threatened and angry when criticized. I have an addictive personality, and I get driven to extremes at times. I'm self-rejecting and self-alienated, often immobilized by anger and frustration. I'm rarely satisfied. I'm usually lonely even when surrounded by people. I'm a chronic complainer who blames others for what's wrong with my life. I feel unappreciated and think I don't fit in. I see the world as a jungle filled with selfish people who aren't there for me. See, this just kind of warms your heart, doesn't it? I see everything as a catastrophe, a life and death situation. I judge life in absolutes, black or white, right or wrong. I live in the past while fearful of the future. What a horrible way to live. I have strong feelings of dependence coupled with exaggerated fears of abandonment. I fear failure and rejection. I don't try new things that may not turn out well. I'm obsessed with money and material things. I dream big plans and schemes, and I have little ability to make any of them happen. I cannot tolerate illness in myself or others. I prefer to charm superiors and intimidate subordinates. I believe that rules and laws are for others, not for me. I often get addicted to excitement and life in the fast lane. I hold emotional pain within, and I lose touch with my feelings. Anybody relate to that? Let me explain, if you relate, and all of us do. These are infantile traits that are continued into adulthood. The name of that article is called King Baby. And that's what we're going to begin to look at as we do inventory. I'll tell you what, it's tough looking the way I look and then acting like that at times. People get confused. He looked so much more mature than that. Why did you do that? Unbelievable. It wasn't that long ago. My boss had asked me about something like for about $8 in my expense account. And I think 2.5 hours later, on my way to Austin, at least 2.5 hours later, I'd resigned and moved on. And I snapped at that. I said, "What is wrong with you? God, you're 55 years old. It's over 20 years. Look what you've done with this." He has a right to ask you about that, for God. He writes your check. Look what you've done with this, you know? Just crazy. This is important because we get drunk behind this, you know. Chris Nara was saying the other day, I'm really not interested in finding my inner child. I need to find my inner adult, and that's the truth. You know, there's nothing wrong with being carefree like a child, but that this infantile stuff that we bring into our life, regardless of length of sobriety, it's killing. It's killing us. It's absolutely killing us in every sense of the word. And it ties back into, I want to read a few lines because I think it's so important to get the clarity of this as it relates to the fourth step. But this is really in the third step, and I'm on page 60 about this requirement that I must be convinced that my life runs self-will can hardly work. And it goes on and describes what it's like when you're living your life on self-will. And I think we just read a great description of the traits, and they're very infantile, that bring about self-will in us. But talks about on that basis, me living my life on my will, or playing God, I'm almost in collision with something or somebody, even though I have good motives. Boy, there's nothing worse than a drunk with a good motive, driven by self-will, right? It says, I try to live by self-propulsion. I'm like an actor, but I want to run the whole show. I'm forever trying to arrange the lights that ballet the scenery and all the other people in my life in my own way. My group, AA, employers, all of that. And then here's my belief system. If my arrangements would only stay put, if only all these people would do as we wish, the show would be great. Just, oh, it warms my heart when I read that. I just, because we know it's so true. Everybody, and this next statement is one of the most delusional in the book, and it's a belief system we have. Everybody, including ourselves, would be pleased. You want to test that? Go ask these people who you're trying to arrange if they're pleased with your arrangements. And now they're going to describe the toolkit of self-will. I can be virtuous to get my way. I can be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. Or I can be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. That's my toolkit of self-will. What usually happens? Well, this show didn't come off very well. I was talking with a gentleman the other day. I listened to a fifth step, and I said, you know, the problem with people like us is we're the director and written the script. Unfortunately, we never give it to any of the other actors. And they begin to do extraneous acting. We get very upset with them for that, you know. So, but it says, well, what happens? This show doesn't come off very well. And because of that, I begin to think life is not treating me right. And I'm going to exert myself more. And I'm going to become, on the next occasion, exerting myself more, either more demanding or gracious. You know how we are. We evaluate the scene. And then we decide which tool we think will now work to get our way once again. I'll send her flowers. You know? That kind of thing. And it goes on and says, unfortunately, though, the play still does not suit us. Admitting we're somewhat at fault, we're absolutely sure, S-U-R-E, other people are much more to blame. And I become angry, indignant, and full of self-pity. And by the way, it always goes that way. When your self-will does not manifest and you're being driven, you'll start with anger. Anger will move into indignant. How dare they? How dare she? How dare he? And then ultimately, you will sit at home or go to your meeting, and you will then be into self-pity. Look at what I've done. Da-da-da. Says, what is my basic trouble? Is my trouble that I'm not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Am I not a victim of it? And it says a delusion. That I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if I only manage well. You know, I threw out a question for some of you to go ask people. How am I showing up in your life? That's tied into this question right here. I want to see if you're a victim of the delusion about your efforts to manage. And the book goes on to say, is it not evident to all the rest of the people in my life, these are the things that I want? And do not my actions make these people wish to retaliate? Column 1 and 2, snatching all they can get out of the show. Am I not, even at my very best, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Talks about I'm self-centered. Turn to page 62 if you have your book. And this ties into inventory. Selfishness, self-centered. That we think is the root of all of our troubles. Now, I want you to think of it this way. You got the word driven. I'm going to show you how you can do an inventory, and it's a full circle. Imagine this is the fourth column first. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity, I step on the toes of my fellows, column 1. They retaliate, column 2. Sometimes they hurt me, column 3. See me without provocation. But I can always find, it says I invariably means always, by the way. I will invariably find that at some time in the past, I have made a decision based on self, column 3, which later placed me in a position to be hurt. It's a full circle. So all my troubles are of my own making. I reap what I sow. I go through life being driven into self-will by fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, self-pity. I make this decision. I pursue this course. At some point in time, they become very aware that I'm trying to arrange them to suit my needs, and they retaliate. So now I'm hurt. I feel hurt, threatened, or interfered, and then I blame them. And it's just a full circle. I started out, and I'm left over on the other side. So all my troubles are of my own making. That's that sentence I told you about. If we went around the room and you all made a list of what your top 10 troubles are, please get an awareness that they're of your own making. And that's good news. That's real good news. These troubles arise out of me, and I am an extreme example of self-will run riot, comma, though I don't think so. That's the other reason I gave you the exercise. Go ask some people who are close to you. How am I showing up to you? How do I show up? If you're in delusion, you don't know you're in delusion. It's nice if you have some people around you care enough about you to tell you that. See? Remember Joe told you that example? I'm talking to him, and he's been out in Santa Monica like a year or two, and you know, well, I got to do this fifth step with Donna. I said, excuse me a minute. But he lives about 2,000 miles away. You need to find somebody in California to read that inventory to and to get accountable to. Oh, my God, I wouldn't have thought of that. You follow me? And then, of course, the line I've talked about, it says, above everything, I must be rid of this selfishness. It's going to be your third and fourth column. I must, or it will kill me. It will kill us. I must, or it will kill us. This is our problem. Every single person in this room who is having any kind of problem whatsoever, it is rooted in your selfishness. It is rooted in your selfishness. And that includes any form of emotional pain, even that surrounding death, death of loved ones. Our name is not in the next sentence.
God makes that possible.
See, if you don't come to the third step understanding this issue of where God fits in it, why would you do the rest of the work? You've got to understand this. The very thing that you're up against right here, right now, today, I don't give a shit about last year or night. I'm talking about the stuff you're up against today that has you miserable, that has you fear-based, that has you afraid, that has you limiting yourself. That stuff, see? Only God can remove that stuff. The stuff that has you in depression, anxiety, sense of separation, dependence, attachments. That's the stuff that I'm talking about. Current stuff today. It goes on and says, and go into your own experience. There seems no way to entirely get rid of self. We could spend a weekend on what they mean by entirely getting rid of self without God's aid. Trust me, if self-will could eliminate self-will, we'd all be doing a lot better. It says you and I have moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we can't live up to them no matter how much we try. Here's why. My moral and philosophical convictions. Let's take one. This manner of living demands rigorous honesty. So I'm going to be honest in all my relationships with people, right? I think we probably, if you've been around AA, I think that's probably a moral philosophical conviction you have. Is that right? Well, how you doing with that? And we all had a lot of struggles. And you know why? Because if I'm rigorously honest with others, that is not going, I'm going to share some stuff and probably, I think, not get some things I think I need that's rooted in my selfishness. That's why your moral and philosophical convictions galore, that and your selfishness will not fit in the same state of consciousness. So you get conflicted all of the time. You get conflicted and you violate your conscience, right? I want to be a good husband, I want to be a good wife or a good member of AA or, you know, I want to do this, I want to do that, give my employer a fair day's work, I want to, and you can't do it and you're conflicted, your conscience, you violate your conscience. And the extent to which you do that is the extent to which you begin to suffer from these things, anxiety and fears. And See, I had to see the truth of that. I have all this moral and philosophical. Joe and I have talked about that. You know, how I you know, I'm up against this stuff, right? All this work, all this stuff is still going on. Where's this stuff coming from, right? I got moral and philosophical convictions galore, and I can't live up to them, right? And I can't reduce this by wishing or trying on my own power. Boy, we do a lot of that, right?
I'm going to pray it away.
You know, that's like praying for the person you're resentful at. Who should be getting your prayers? You or them? Resentment's the number one offender. I don't think they have a problem. I don't think they need your prayer. I think you need your prayer. See? Well, I'm going to pray for them. They're just fine. You're the problem. Your troubles are of your own making. Write some inventory and you'll find out what I mean. They're okay, see? So, you know, you get done with this and it ends. It says, I had to have God's help. Do you? Right here, right now, today, you know? So this is how I'm going to get God's help. A lot of people don't understand this. See, first thought, I gotta have God's help. Okay, so now this is how. Pretty important, don't you think? If you have to have it, and how?
You're going to quit playing God.
What do you mean? That great question, right? What do you mean? I mean you're going to quit playing God. Well, could you be a little more specific? Yeah, you, for example, you're just going to allow all the people in your life just to be who they are. And you're going to love them exactly as they are, and nothing in them needs to change. Nothing. Or you change. Wow. And you're going to quit bitching about your boss and you're going to quit playing God. It's not your business how long people are supposed to live and die and who gets sober and who not. You're going to quit playing God. Not your business about here. Wow. Pretty radical stuff, right? You know? But the only way you're going to get God's help is to quit playing God. See, why would God assist you if you think you're God? See? My experience is God comes into empty vessels, not full ones. See? So how do you empty the vessel out? Steps 4 through 9. You empty the vessel out. So I got to quit playing God. See? My standard response probably to so many questions anymore, I don't know. I don't know. You know? Why? I'm not God. There's such a huge picture. Isn't anybody in this room that is even remotely has any idea about how God works? And if you think you do, come talk to me. The picture is huge. So huge. I think several years ago, I think Joe might have started doing some work with Larry. And as I think that's kind of, and as a result, you're all sitting here, so it's their true fault, right? But I mean, the point that I'm trying to make is nobody in this room has any idea how God works. And the picture is so big and so vast, you know, that it's beyond our comprehension. So I'm going to quit playing God. Why? Because me playing God does not work. Me playing God does not work. So that's that question we've thrown out to you several times. How's it working? Look at your life right now. Your life. Nobody else's. How's it working, you playing God? How is that working for you? See? That's the acid test. Is it working for you? It says it doesn't work. My experience is it doesn't work. Me playing God. Now we got that decision that we're going to make. We're going to say that prayer. Now we're going to get some instructions on inventory, and I want to talk about some of those for a little bit. I like writing inventory. And the reason is because I understand what's going to happen to me as a result of that. I want to make this statement. I think it's very important. Do not let other people read your big book for you. Do not let your sponsor read your big book for you. Don't let anyone read your big book for you. You need to have an idea of what your big book says and you need to read your big book. And that's the place to go when in doubt or if you're looking for instructions. Okay? So we get done with this third step and we say this prayer, which is an affirmation of our decision. And it talks about next, we're going to launch out on a vigorous action, course of vigorous action, which is going to be a house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. And prior to that, the big book says that you're going to experience the great reality of this power that you need deep down within yourself, but that you're blocked. So think of the inventory as this. We're going to do steps 4 through 9 to face and be rid of that which has me blocked from the power that I so desperately need in my life, to not drink and to have a life of some peace, some dignity, some integrity. Am I willing to do that? Face and be rid of that which has me blocked from that which resides within as well as without. It says, though my third step decision, I'm on page 64, was vital and crucial, it, by the way, anytime the big book uses the word it, please know what it means. So it, in this case, is my third step decision. That decision will have little permanent effect, highlight those two words, unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and to be rid of the things in myself which have been blocking me from God, from knowing God. I didn't say believing in God. I said knowing God. Knowing God. See? My God, what a difference. What a difference that is. Between believing in God and knowing God. And then those of you who think liquor is your problem, the next sentence, if your book says the same thing, mine is going to be problematic for you because your liquor is but a symptom. Your drugs is but a symptom. Whatever your first step is but a symptom. So we're going to get down to causes, second column, and conditions, third column. We're going to start upon a personal inventory. This is going to be fact-finding, fact-facing, effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. This self-will run riot, this troubles of my own making that arise from within myself. We're going to search out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Interesting, the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self, which manifests in many ways, was what had defeated us, we're going to consider the common manifestations of self. And then we're going to look at three inventories. How many of you have relapsed before? Raise your hands. Okay? Here's why. Resentment is the number one offender. Resentment destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From resentment stem all forms of spiritual disease. For I have been not only mentally and physically ill, and the big book's already talked about that, I have been spiritually sick. Now this next sentence is a great promise, and it's also a great warning. The promise is, when the spiritual malady is overcome, I will straighten out mentally and physically. The warning is, if the spiritual malady is not overcome, you will not straighten out mentally and physically, and you probably will drink again and or just be miserable. Now you're going to get the instructions. You're going to put them on paper. You're going to make a list of people, institutions, and principles. Column one, go back. Let the inventory flow out of you. You're going to get done with that, and you're going to take the first name in the list, and you're going to begin to write the second column. I love to write the second column. It's what those SOBs have done. You know, I love it. I let it go. I get graphic. You know, I use the kind of words that I would really use if I was being genuine and authentic. I don't say cute little things like, oh, he hurt my feelings. It's much more graphic than that. I use bullets. I also like to get very specific, you know. So I write all the second column on all those people. Big book shows a couple different ways of doing it. One is, most of the time, we have anywhere from, if you got one name over here, we have 5 to 10 things that they've done that we're a little upset about. And so you can group them. I've done that before. Or you can write separately on each one, and I've done that before. Now, I stay very, very current. because I believe my big book, and it has been my experience, resentment's the number one offender. So my deal right now is if in my evening review a name comes up three consecutive nights, I will write a four-column inventory, do a fifth step, six, seven, eight, and if amend is owed, I will make the amend. That's what I use as a barometer. Why? Because it's the number one offender. It will destroy me quicker than anything else. So why would I not do that, right? So there's a couple different ways then that you can work with your second column, but be specific. Don't bullshit yourself. Write down the truth of what happens in there. So you get done with all these second columns. Now you're going to go with the third column. Three words I work with: hurt, threatened, or interfered. If I'm mad at Bob in column one because in column two he stole my girlfriend, then I'm going to ask myself, how did that hurt, threaten, or interfere? And I'm going to look at seven areas of self. Self-esteem, how I see and feel about myself. Pride, how others see me. Ambition, what do I want? Boy, I touched that one too. What do I want? I want him on his knees begging my forgiveness. You know? Want respect, want just, you know, man, I touch that stuff, see? Security, what I need to be okay. A belief system, what I think I need to be okay, right? Personal relations, same sex. Sex relations. Belief systems about men and women. Money, I am my money. See? A lot of inventory written around money. Do you think your money defines you? I am my money. Got to get done with the third column. Page and a half of instructions that lead us into the fourth column. I want to mention a couple things about this. I'm on page 60. The big book is, you get done writing the first three columns. Big book says when you're done with those first three columns, you need to consider it carefully. First thing apparent was the world and its people, column one, are often quite wrong, column two. To conclude others were wrong, column two, as far as I ever got. And then you bring that into the meetings I go to about what she did and he did. Follow me? Do you hear what the book just said? Use your outcome. These people continue to wrong me, column two, and I stayed sore, column three. Sometimes it's remorse, and then I'm mad at myself. But the more I fight and try and have my own way, the worse things got. It should be plain to me that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. If you ever ask yourself the question why your resentments are futile, it's a great question. I'll do something I don't normally do. I'm going to give you an answer. Because you have no power or control over other people's behavior toward you. So it's futile. Deep resentments lead to futility and then unhappiness. To the precise extent that I permit these, that's an interesting word, permit. Book earlier told you resentment's the number one offender. Now it's using the word permit. You know why? Because they've showed you a tool to get rid of them. So that to the precise extent that I permit these resentments, do I squander the hours it could have been worthwhile? But with me, whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is grave. Matter of fact, we find it, resentments, fatal. For when I harbor such feelings, I'm going to shut myself off from the sunlight of the Spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns. I drink again with me. To drink is to die. Simplistic way to explain to you my experience with what I just read. If I am resentful at one person, God is everything and everywhere. God lies within the person. If I am resentful at one person, I'm cut off from God. And you multiply that times 10, and you multiply that times 15. That's what the book means when it says you're cut off from the sunlight of the Spirit, because God resides in that which you are resentful at. You have just cut yourself off from God. We aren't the kind of people who function very well, very long with that feeling of separation once again, and then we become diseased. And at some point, our mind, to give us some sense of ease and comfort, says, I know, Mark, what will give you ease and comfort is a drink. And at certain times, because of a phenomenon called a strange mental blank spot, and because of the pain that I put myself in behind this resentment and being blocked from that which keeps me from being in this state, I say, you know what? I think that's a good idea. And I go take a drink. And I activate a phenomenon called craving. All behind a resentment that has me blocked from God because I'm playing God, being driven by self-will. And I'm unwilling to write the inventory to complete the inventory. See? If I'm to live, I got to be free of this anger. It doesn't say you won't be angry. I still get angry. I just don't get involved with it. There's a difference. Grouch and the brainstorm are not for us. They're the dubious luxury of normal people, but for a drunk, these things are poison. So I'm going to turn back to this list, the first three columns, for it holds the key to the future. By the way, that's another great topic to start talking about in your meetings that we never talk about. Let me read this sentence. I'm going to turn back to this list, for this list holds the key to my future.
I think that's pretty important.
The key to your future rests in this list. Why aren't we talking about this? Think about what the book says. You follow me? You can't believe some of the book and not all the book, by the way. You can't. This isn't, pick and choose, smorgasbord. Well, I think I'll do a resentment inventory, but leave off fear and sex, and I'll, yeah, okay. This holds the key to the future. Key to the future, right? You don't think they meant the key to the future. Yeah, it means the key to your future. See, the rest of this process that you're going to get taken through. And now you're going to get some instructions. You're going to look at, there's that word it again. You're going to look at this whole thing from an entirely different angle. This ties into theater of the lie. You're going to begin to see the world and its people, column one, really dominate you, column two. Now pay attention. In that state, it's your third column, it's a state of being. The wrongdoing of others, column two, fancy real, has the power to kill. Actually kill. Earlier on, the book, big book says your selfishness will kill you. You're going to see this afternoon, we do Theater of the Lie. You're going to see in the third column why you're fighting for your life. You're going to see why you get drunk. How do we escape? These resentments must be mastered. How do I do that? Can't wish them away more in alcohol, so this is going to be the course we're going to take. We're going to realize the people in column one who wronged us, column two, were perhaps spiritually sick. Though I don't like their symptoms, second column, why you're angry, and the way they disturb me, third column, they, like me, are sick too. I call this the bridge to freedom. It begins with this concept. To understand that there are things that people have done, actions they've taken in the second column that have had an impact on your life. It's introducing you to the idea that perhaps that happened because they were spiritually sick. Perhaps they don't understand there's nothing but oneness. Perhaps they're sound asleep, dreaming they're awake. Perhaps they're like you, going through life being driven. And you're going to sit in judgment on them. You begin to understand something. They're spiritually sick, and then I'm sitting here judging a spiritually sick person, thinking they could have done something different. I love what the Four Agreements says. He says, don't take anything personal. And the reason you and I take things personal, and he says, I love it. He says, it's because of my selfishness. I thought, man, that guy's written inventory before. And he goes on to say that absolutely nothing any human being has ever done is because of you. Wow. What a concept. Your actions have nothing to do with me? I can't imagine that, because after all, I'm me. You follow? And it goes on to say, I'm going to ask God, help me show these people I've written all this inventory on that I'm mad at, the same tolerance, pity, and patience I'm cheerfully grant a sick friend. Are you going to get a, you got a friend in a hospital bed dying of cancer. He calls you a name. He assassinates your character. You're going to get mad? No. He's probably not feeling very well, right? Dying of cancer. You're going to grant him tolerance, pity, and patience. That's what the book's trying to say. It's trying to shift you to look at things and understand people don't do this stuff intentionally. Your mothers and fathers, they weren't poor parents because they went to the counselor in high school and said, "You have a program in which I can be a poor parent? I'd like to raise an alcoholic son or daughter." Who's packed full of resentments? I want to make sure I never demonstrate love to him either. You get it? You start to go, oh my God. I've been carrying all this resentment. Like these people, you know. I'll throw out something here. There's no such thing as free will. Is it possible? As you sit here, you didn't choose your name, you didn't choose your gender, you didn't choose the state you're living in, you didn't choose any of that. You didn't choose a single belief system that was fostered on you from birth to age 10. Not a single one. You didn't choose it. Not one single thought that you had in your mind from probably birth to 10 did you have any say in, and all of that has determined the course of action, how you lived your life since then. And is it possible you're just operating on the delusion that you're making choices about things? What kind of people would make choices if that was true, like the ones we've made? Is it possible that I'm suffering from this delusion that me and all these other people are making choices? Is that a possibility? And in fact, they're not, and maybe that's what this concept of spiritually sick is all about. There's probably a lot to be said. Was you're getting people's best shot, including your own. Take a chill pill on yourself and take a chill pill on them. Sit with that a little bit. My experience is a computer can only put out predicated in the software. And if you want to get new information, my experience is you got to put in new software. That's what steps 4 through 9 do. They reprogram you. They give you new software. And lo and behold, new data starts coming out. Not because you chose to. See? New data starts coming out. Something to think about. This process, see? Changes your programming. Then a whole different set of circumstances and responses begins to manifest outside of you. So you get this prayer. Talks about taking a kind and tolerant view. Then it talks about a fourth column. Then we're going to talk about a fear inventory. A lot of different ways you can write. I think it's wonderful they have fear squeezed between a resentment and a sex inventory. And we're going to talk about a fear inventory this afternoon. You'll see some of that in Theater of Lie. Then you get a sex inventory where you're going to make another list. You're going to answer a whole bunch of questions about this area. And you get done with that, and you're going to do a fifth step. Then you're going to identify a whole bunch of defects as a result of reading that inventory. Then you're going to say a prayer in the seventh step, and then you're going to come out of that, spend a period of time making your eight-step list, drawing it from your inventories, asking God to show you any other harm you put out into the universe. Keep adding that to the list, free of any judgment. Then you're going to make sure you're clear in the instructions for amends, and you're going to begin to start making amends. I had a person ask me about this who has some unfinished amends they're aware of. And she asked what I think was a great question, which was, what can I do? I said, would you really like to get those amends made? Are you willing to make them? She said, yeah, I believe I am now. After Joe scared me so much. I said, well, here's what you do. You find a couple people in the program that you're accountable to, and here's what you tell them. You go up to them and say, you know what? I think there's a level of consciousness that I want to experience. And I think the only way that this is going to happen is that I finish these amends. So from now till the day I die, every time you see me or talk to me in the telephone, after you say hello, your very next question to me is this. How many of those amends have you made? And I said, you give them consent to do that. Two people. And every time, I mean every time, that is their second question out of their mouth after hello. How many have you made? And I said, that will help you get some power to make these amends. Use some spiritual brothers or sisters to move you through this process. See, you can use the ego. Trust me, at some point in time, she's going to get tired of that question. Mm-hmm. I don't care what motivates or moves someone through. You can use the ego. See? My ego is my friend. Here's why I say that. If it's not here, it's because I'm probably dead. So use it. See? So that's all I got for now on that.
Good stuff. Simple, but not easy. And if you think you got to muster up the power to do 4 through 9, you're missing something in 1, 2, and 3. You know how you've done step 3? You got a pen and a piece of paper out and you're making a list. I have a poem written by a friend of mine. It's called The Paradox of Our Age. We have bigger houses and smaller families. More conveniences but less time. We have degrees but less sense. We have more knowledge but less judgment. More experts but more problems. More medicine but less health. We've been all the way to the moon and back but have trouble crossing the street to meet a newcomer. We build more computers to hold more information to produce more copies than ever, but have less communication with each other. We've been long on quantity but short on quality. These are times of fast foods and slow digestion, tall men with short character, steep profits and shallow relationships. It is a time when there is much more in the window and nothing in the storeroom. This was written by the 14th Dalai Lama after a visit with President Bush. We're going to take a break in a couple minutes. We're going to come back and have questions and answers until lunchtime. We're going to take lunch from 12:30 to 2. We're going to do as much as we can this afternoon. You'll really enjoy Theater of the Lie. It's a lot of fun. But I wanted to talk about a couple things with the first 3 steps. You can go forward through the first 3 steps. You can go backwards through the first 3 steps. It's never a bad time during inventory. You need a little oomph. You start with the ABCs and ask yourself with the paragraph above the ABCs, the description of the alcoholic, my first step, the chapter to the agnostic, my second step, and my personal adventures before the first drink and after the first drink. I never knew what before and after meant until I looked at what they'd said in the description of the alcoholic and the chapter to the agnostic. Drunk or sober, am I convinced that I am an alcoholic? A lot of people need to become convinced that they're alcoholic and that their life is unmanageable sober, just as much as they needed to be convinced that they were alcoholic and their life was unmanageable drunk. That's when I was stuck on the dash for the first time. That no human power, oh, there's a trap there, I missed the trap, went right over the trap word, that probably no human power can relieve my alcoholism. There's a good word to pause on and ask yourself, are there any probablys? You got any probablys in your life that might be able to relieve your alcoholism? Look for the probablys. They'll take you to a new admission with the B. And see that God has and will. Never had a problem with can he. I've pretty much known he can. But he just wasn't going to do it for me. We got too many examples that God can. But the one that always gets me, whether it's in C or whether it's in the 6-step questions, is, will he, for me, as I am, with all this mud on my face from the first 3 steps that I've just seen, with all this current unmanageability, which is my current agnosticism, which is the areas where I'm running my life on self-will. That's what I really want you to see, because it's so easy to clearly see that the list of current unmanageability is connected to the list of current agnosticism. It's a reflection. They might even be the same words. And it's easy to see that the current agnosticism is connected to the current list of where you're running your life on self-will. But here's the trick. You got to take those lists as they grow and as they change and make sure they're still connected to a drink. Or You'll be stuck on the dash, and you'll be doing the work because of the second half of step one. And as soon as things straighten out emotionally or the circumstances in your life, you'll poop out because you'll be doing 1 through 9 based on the unmanageability, and the unmanageability won't have shit all to do with the first half of step one because you got stuck on the dash. So when you make that first list of current unmanageability, if you got to put something next to it, see that under the manifestation of the current unmanageability is a drink of alcohol or a drug or both. Get clear in the first half of step one whether you're powerless over where alcohol takes you. And isn't it amazing? They always call the drug that we have no choice over your drug of choice. Is it possible your drug of choice was your drug of no choice? I'll tell you what my drug of choice was. Yours. My drug of choice. Those would be the same people that think they have a choice whether to drink or use drugs again today. Because all they ever did was their drug of choice. Go up to some of those people that say their drug of choice and say, is it possible? That's the phrase in my home group when you hear, you just get a little leery, right? Is it possible that the drug you think was your drug of choice was actually your drug of no choice? Care enough to ask people that are dying. Ask yourself, do you care whether alcoholics and addicts continue to live and die?